This podcast is supported by The Real Real.
You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
It's good to have a professional in anything you do in life.
So I sought one out, and this guy is amazing. I'm so excited he agreed to come on to speak to us about this topic and kind of what he's experienced, what I've experienced, and he's very well-versed. He
very smart guy.
Yeah, Walker. I can't say that really fast. Walker Larson. So he writes for the Epoch Times, the Federalist. He has a Substack. He is a teacher, professor. He has his master's in English. He's just a very well-versed person, and he speaks on this topic quite a bit. He writes about it quite a bit, and I read a lot of his works, and I thought he would be perfect to come on and speak to us about this and see if I'm just going insane, if this is something that's all in my head, it's all in your head, or no. What we're hearing and seeing in the rhetoric that's being used today is a kind of quasi neo-Marxism that, you know, it's a little terrifying.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. I felt like I was in a classroom learning.
Yeah, I felt like I'm back at UW.
I was learning. Much unlike what I did when I was actually in college.
Yeah. Isn't that funny? Do you remember college?
I do remember some of it, but most of it was pertaining to partying.
And
what is it pertain? What is it pertain?
What is that from?
Beverly Hills Cop. Thank you. Good movie. What is it pertain? I love that movie. Yeah, so very interesting guy. I felt like we learned a lot and got to exchange some good dialogue here, and I hope you guys enjoy it.
Let's just go to the basics. And some people kind of tell me, Sarah, you don't know what you're talking about. You don't even know what communism is. So I'm going to ask you, a professional, very basic question, like we are in elementary school. Walker, what is communism?
Well, I think that's the right place to start.
Yeah.
Because the term does get thrown around a lot.
Sure,
you
does.
Know, and with greater or lesser precision. And so I can try to give a simple definition. Again, there's probably other people out there who could give better definitions, but I would say it is a political and economic system based on the abolition of private property, mm-hmm. Where the government or the collective, depending on how you look at it, is going to own all the means of production, mm-hmm. Economic production. And then the members of that society, in theory, would each kind of receive an equal, more or less equal portion of the produce that comes out of that system. Now, in practice, it tends to be not quite so fair. And it's founded on a principle that's against the natural law, or it's against Catholic teaching based on the natural law, which is that we do have the right to private property simply by virtue of being human beings. And then again, in practice, it tends to take a very totalitarian form. So if you look at Soviet Russia or Maoist China, it ends up with this very powerful centralized government that controls really every aspect of your life as much as they can. So it's not just controlling the economy, it's also controlling what ideas you're exposed to. It's controlling what you're allowed to say. It's controlling whether you're allowed to be religious, practice your faith, things like that. So yeah, it takes a very totalitarian form, at least the way we've seen it play out in history.
And they're atheists, right? I mean, they don't believe in a religion or people basing their lives, even their politics, off of a religion. They basically want to eliminate that and kind of be the substitute for that. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. At least the historical forms of it that we've seen, like in Russia, it's very atheistic. Yeah. It's based on the philosophy of Karl Marx, right? So Marxism is a materialist philosophy, where the theory is what you can see and touch is all there is. There is nothing spiritual. We're purely chemicals in our bodies, right? And society is really just about human beings trying to produce the goods that they need for their physical bodies to continue. And so it completely cuts God out of the picture. And and it does tend to be anti-religious. I mean, famously, you know, Marx and Hegel talk about religion as the opium of the people, meaning that it's something that was invented by capitalists, basically, or by the upper classes to keep the lower classes in check.
Yeah.
So in other words, if you create these, as they would say, these myths about religion, you can keep people sort of subdued and content with their unjust lot because you're promising them a reward in the afterlife that in the eyes of Marx will never come, right? But he's saying it's just a way of controlling people. So that would be one of the main reasons why Marxists and communists then tend to be atheist and against religion. Now, again, I don't want to paint with too broad of a brush. There have been so many different Marxist thinkers, and it kind of has broken down into different strains of thought. We can get into that. But yeah, as a general rule, yes, very atheistic. And as you said, the state itself, the communist ideology itself, is going to replace God. It's supposed to become the religion, right? You totally belong to the state. You're totally dedicated to the state. And the state takes care of you in the way that God would take care of you.
Sounds a little familiar.
So I know a lot of people that maybe don't know specifically like the history. What, to some people, you say, people talk about socialism. Like, what is the difference between, from on that basic level, what is the difference between socialism and communism? Or really, is there a difference?
I feel like it's, and let me jump in. I feel like, in to our listeners too, like it's kind of getting blurred. It's kind of, there's not like a long pathway. It's kind of just being like scrunched together now when you think of the two.
Yeah, well, I think it is a bit of a blurry line. And I think some people would argue that they are the same thing, just communism is the most extreme form of it. It's like kind of the final stage, if you will. So yeah, the best I could say on that is, with socialism, you're again advocating for more and more government involvement and control over the means of production. Maybe you don't totally abolish private property in a socialist system.
You still own stuff, right? There's still ownership, correct, in socialism. It's not a complete, you know, annihilation of ownership where it's bread store. I don't know. Like, food.
Right. Yeah. I think it's somewhere in the middle where, you know, there's some degree of private property that still exists. Mm-hmm. You can still own things, but, you know, more and more, you know, the government is going to be taking care of the economy, medical system, and what goods are available and how things are produced and distributed. And then, yeah, in communism, as I said, basically just the most extreme form of that, it would be the complete abolition of private property. Yeah. So you own nothing.
You own nothing.
Everyone is expected to contribute to the collective and then to receive something back according to your needs, in theory. Now, it doesn't always play out that way
in reality, but that's
the idea.
But just real quickly, what is your thought? Because we were against communism in America. I mean, there was a whole thing about, are you a communist? You know, mm-hmm. What happened? When did it start to seep into our schools, into people's, you know, I mean, just academia and just, I mean, not even today. I'm speaking like, I don't know, you would know better than I, when this started to infiltrate. And then my next question is, why? Why?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This podcast is supported by The Real Real. You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts, but not just any gifts, real gifts, thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail? Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
Well, that's a big question. I'll do my best to tackle it. Yeah, I can definitely speak to how some of these ideas came over here. And I want to preface this by saying that, you know, the world of ideas and ideologies is complex, and you can have an idea that comes over from, let's say, from Soviet Russia, mm-hmm. and then it's going to kind of mix with some ideas we have swirling around already.
Yeah.
And what you get is something that's perhaps communist influenced, but is probably no longer pure communism in the traditional sense. So I do want to be clear about that, right? Like that. You're probably not going to find a ton of outright communists in colleges who are like saying, let's abolish all property and you know, set up the new Soviet Russia or something.
Yeah.
There might be a few.
There might be. I think I met a few at University of Washington, but that's fine.
Yeah. They are out there. And what you will find is a heavily, heavily communist or Marxist influenced set of ideas.
Yes.
That dominate in education. So I can try to trace that story a little bit here. Okay. So if we go back to, you know, like the Soviet Russia, China, these countries where Marx's ideas were actually put into practice. And what resulted was these communist states that were very centralized, very totalitarian, basically tried to force the system of Marx onto people. And the results were pretty catastrophic. I mean, we're talking death tolls of easily 100 million people in the 20th century in these different communist regimes. Now, part of their goal, though, was there's always been an international dimension to it, right? So the Soviet Russia, you know, they wanted to exert their influence beyond just their borders, right? And many communists talked about, let's try to establish a one world state, mm-hmm. Communist state. So, and of course, the U.S. Was the big adversary of Soviet Russia, and so the Soviet Union, which was more than just Russia, but primarily Russia, and so they're targeting the United States as the big obstacle to this, or one of the big obstacles. And so there's pretty good evidence, I would say, that there was an intentional attempt on the part of communist agents to infiltrate our educational system. Again, this is not like settled history. People disagree on this, but as we mentioned before, you know, I have written on this, and I can list some of the people, mostly former communists, who came out in, say, like the 20s or the mid 20th century, and said, "This is what we were trying to do. This is what we are trying to do." So, like Louis Boudens, W. Skousen, Bella Dodd, J.B.
Skousen.
Matthews, as well as some communist publications, they all testified that yes, this is something that the communists were trying to do, was to infiltrate the educational system. And it makes sense, because if you want to undermine a nation, you want to instill your ideas into the next generation and future generations, to bring them over to your way of thinking, to a communist way of thinking. So we know, we have pretty good evidence. I guess I shouldn't say we know, and others might dispute this, but I think there's good evidence that there was some attempt at that. Now, how successful were they? Would be more of a matter of debate, but we definitely know that what would be one of the main theories or sets of ideas that dominate in higher education and academia is something called critical theory. You've probably heard that term. Maybe critical race theory has been around in the news quite a bit in recent years, and that would be a kind of a subcategory of critical theory. And critical theory was originated by a group of Marxist intellectuals called the Frankfurt School. So they were German Marxist intellectuals who started in Germany, in Frankfurt. But then they were fleeing the Nazis. And so they came over to Columbia University in here in the US and started to spread their ideas here. So critical theory is, as I said, it's the probably the main lens through which modern academics approach subjects like literature, history, social sciences, the arts, politics. It's very prevalent. I'm not saying it's the only in kind of idea that you'll encounter, but it would be probably the dominant one that you'll find in not every, but a lot, or the majority of American universities, would be critical theory. And so critical theory is directly traceable back to Marxist intellectuals. Like, that's not, I don't think that's really disputed. I think everyone kind of acknowledges
Agree.
that. Now, I will make a distinction between strictly communist intellectuals and Marxist intellectuals, because after the disasters of the 20th century with the attempts at Marxism, there were Marxists who were honest enough to say, "This did not work. These governments in Russia or China or wherever you want to say were way too totalitarian. They were way too tyrannical. They didn't do socialism right. They didn't do Marxism right." And you know, there's kind of a joke about this, like, you know, the only, you know, you'll find Marxists who always say that the attempts were never the real form of it, right? We just have to try one more time and we'll get the real form of it, which at this point, it's like there's enough data to show that that's not going to work. But anyway, there were Marxists who were critical of this, and so would not call themselves communists per se. They would not have that same totalitarian edge to them, but they still believed in a lot of basic Marxist principles. And they still believed, for example, at least in the beginning, that capitalism is inherently unjust and is inherently oppressive. So they still believe that. And I think here it's helpful to understand maybe how classical Marxism, you know, which we get from Marx, transforms into what we might call neo-Marxism or new Marxism or post-Marxism, which is, you know, it's similar, but it's different. It derives from Marx, but it definitely has its own characteristics, and we don't want to confuse the two too much. Because if you know, again, if you call someone, "Oh, you're a Marxist," they might say, "Well, I don't, you know, I don't believe that class conflict is the only issue in society. That's outdated, right?" But they do believe that some form of conflict is what drives society, so and drives history. So if I could, and feel free to interrupt me if I'm going
No,
on too long, but if I
no, this is
could maybe
fascinating.
give the way that we transition from one to the other. So you have these Marxists who are questioning maybe the way that Marxism has been done, but a lot of them, especially figures like George Lukács from Hungary, there was a communist government in Hungary that he was a part of, and Antonio Gramsci, who is an Italian communist and philosopher, they're asking this question, basically, why hasn't Marx's prediction come true? Because Marx predicted, he theorized that inevitably what will happen is eventually the lower classes will realize that they're being oppressed by the upper classes, and they will revolt and establish the world communist state. So he just took this as a grant, like this is going to happen. It's the drive of history will make that happen. And but here we, time passed and it hadn't happened. I mean, there were countries that attempted it, right? It didn't work so well. But certainly, like largely in the West, in Europe and America, it hadn't happened. There was no communist revolution. And so there were these theorists like Gramsci or Louis Althusser, who's a French Marxist, who asked the question, why hasn't this worked? Because they still believe, they believe.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
It must happen, right? It's
Yeah.
almost like it's almost like a religious belief, like this apocalypse will happen and will usher in this earthly paradise. And the answer that they came up with, basically, was, well, the upper classes or the bourgeoisie in the West, they're maintaining their power through culture, not just through economics, but through culture and through the ideas that culture transmits. And so they really started to shift the focus away from classical Marxism about economic conflict to questions of culture and
Culture.
How does culture play into power? How do
Yeah.
people maintain their power using cultures?
Yeah.
This was their theory, right? Is that
Brilliant.
basically everything you and I would consider art or religion or even family life, like traditional values, that all of that was just a screen, was just like a tool for the capitalists to stay in power, which is kind of absurd on the face of it, but that was
Yeah.
the way they interpreted those things. And so and this is also the Frankfurt School, like I mentioned critical theory, right? They were definitely building on this idea that the real battle is not so much economic as it is cultural. And
Yeah.
so what critical theory did, building on, I would say, the ideas of like Gramsci, is said basically transferred the idea of the class conflict, which is classical Marx, and they just applied that same lens to other social groups. So now for them, the kind of the important thing going on in society, and also the way to achieve revolution in society, is not through, or not solely through, the conflict between rich and poor, but it's the conflict between blacks and whites. It's
Race,
the conflict between
religion.
gays and straights. It's the conflict between men and women.
So it's identity
and
politics.
So
it's more identity. It's they focus more on what we're seeing now. I don't mean to interrupt you. I'm sorry, but it's this what I'm seeing more and more. We talk about it all the time. Is this identity politics being used in a very Marxist way? And sorry, I'll let you continue, but I agree 100%. We see it all the time. Yeah.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. Yeah. It is identity politics. It is pitting one social group against another, and it's viewing the world in a very binary way, a very black and white way of it's oppressor versus oppressed. And that's kind of the lens that they just take to everything. Like, so literature, for example, which is my specialty, I mean, that's what I studied in grad school. Very often, the approach that the modern critics in academia would take would be to read a book, of a work of literature, a novel, simply to kind of identify in this story who is the oppressor and who is the oppressed. And depending on what your particular interest as a critic was, maybe you would say, well, if you're a feminist critic, for example, you would say, well, you know, the female characters are oppressed in this story, and the male characters are oppressing them. Or if you're, let's say, you're a post-colonial critic and you're reading William Shakespeare's *The Tempest*, they would look at that from a very specific angle, and they would say this play is really a demonstration of how the colonizers oppress the colonized.
Yeah. Yes,
very much so.
Even though.
Are they manipulating the... So what you're trying to say is that they're manipulating, they're kind of changing what it really is, and they're trying to, like, they're forming it to their own, like, identity politics type of standard. Is that what you're saying? Like, they're changing what it truly is meant to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, in many cases, I think that's accurate. It's trying to fit the work of literature or art or history into your preconceived notion that the world operates on the basis of conflict between oppressor and oppressed.
And that's to divide us.
Which is a really simplistic way to view the world. Sorry?
And that's to divide us, correct? I mean, that's the purpose behind that is, if you have the objective, is to pit, say, he and I against each other in an academic environment, where then now I'm just being indoctrinated by this, oh, we're oppressed, you're the oppressor. And it's just, is that what you're saying, how it kind of infiltrated the schools and universities?
Right. I think that definitely was at least part of the purpose of it, was to pit people against each other, to stoke conflict, because you need conflict and distrust in order to affect revolution, right? Yes. If you want to change the existing social structure, you have to destabilize it. You have to get people to distrust it. You have to get people to hate it, in fact. And so with critical theory, which again comes over to us from German Marxists, it comes to the US, it spreads throughout academia. Critical theory it's just what it sounds like. It's about critiquing or attacking or questioning kind of everything people took for granted in like normal American society before that, right? So it's questioning religion, it's questioning marriage. They came to present marriage as an oppressive
form
thing.
Of oppression.
It's questioning racial relations. It's questioning the purpose of art. It's just to get people to kind of doubt everything, question government, right? People to doubt all of these things and all of the institutions that maybe we used to just trust in, normal human institutions like churches and education itself. Now, of course, we could say, well, they've been taken over by these ideas, so maybe they're less trustworthy than they were. But, you know, at the time that this is going on, that was maybe new to people, this idea that, oh, maybe I shouldn't trust what I was, these kind of common American assumptions and Western assumptions, Western values.
Yeah.
They were taken for granted, right? I mean, that's what people were raised in. And now these guys come in and they say, well, actually, those assumptions are really just tools of the powerful to keep you oppressed. They use ideas like religion, to prevent you from realizing that you are being that you are part of an unjust system and that you are a victim. And our job, they would say, as intellectuals, is to show you that you are actually a victim.
Where
And
does all, sorry.
so yeah, to your point, it was to divide people. I think it was to destabilize society and to get people to question what we would call traditional values or many values that we would hold as Catholics,
Yeah.
right? They wanted people to discard.
100%.
So you even talked about your Substack about, I think it was Lenin that said, "You give me 4 years, and I'll plant the seed that you will never be able to." I forget how what the ending of that phrase is, but he's basically saying he plants the seed, and you'll never be able to turn back from it, right? And I think about our country and all the things you're saying, and it's like, where is the drive coming from? It's like, what groups, where is the
I
funding
was just gonna
coming
say,
from?
what who
Like
is,
specifically where?
and since we are so against it for so long, why, it's not done by accident, and who in even
Yeah, it's
academia
like,
is saying, let's go? Like, I mean,
like it's not
these are
just the
trigger
Soviets.
words that I would think most of us would say, wait a minute. And we're going to talk about your time in college, because you and I had a very, we have very similar stories. When I went to UW, when I walked out of many lectures and professors, because it was complete Marxist, complete anti-capitalistic teachings, no other viewpoints. But what you're saying is,
Yeah, like
where is this?
is it coming from the old Lenin all that Soviet infiltration? Like,
And
is
was it just
it those
accepted?
seeds that have been sown, or are we having like where is the enemy? You
And
know what I
who gave
mean?
the green light? I'm sorry, we're just piling this on right now, because this, we're very passionate. Like, who
Yeah.
gave the green light? Because you can't just hire anybody to come teach at a school. You can't just hire a school teacher in an element. I could talk about my Catholic high school in Seattle. You
Sure.
can't. I mean, today,
Want to make a difference in your community, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
But like,
Yeah.
you can't just, it doesn't just happen on accident. So somebody has to hire them. Somebody has to know their positions. They have to continue to put these opinions into our schools.
Yeah,
And
and it's an obvious cultural push that it's very apparent if you pay attention to any of the news that's on television,
so
you know?
who's doing it? And we talk about, well, I mean, Charlie Kirk, and who went to these colleges and just kind of debated against it. But anyways, like, do you know
Yeah.
the answer to that? Like, who and why? So sorry.
I think I can only give bits and pieces of what I know. You know, I think it's a complicated issue, and I don't want to oversimplify it by saying, "Oh, it's just this group of people over here. They're the bad guys." It's more complicated than that, but I can try to answer it. So I would say number one is a lot of people adopt these let's say identity politics, what today we call wokeism is kind of the newest term for it. A lot of people adopt that with the best of intentions, right? They adopt it because they think that it's the compassionate view to take. So if you genuinely believe, for example, that I don't know, pick whichever marginalized group you want to, let's say you don't have a good understanding of morality and of what really is good for people and makes people happy, and you really believe that the LGBT community is being treated unfairly. Well, if you really believe that, then sure, the compassionate thing to do would be to try to unveil this
Of
oppression
course,
and
yeah.
work against this
Of
oppression.
course.
Right. So I do want to make that point, and I think this is the case with a lot of my professors, for example. They're not bad people. They were people who thought that they were standing up for genuine victims. Now, I think they had been misled in many cases, and it was really more about fostering this revolutionary spirit, you know. But yeah, so there are people who are just perpetuating it out of good intentions, and that's probably the majority, to be honest. But there's also funding, you know, plays into it. So I on my Substack, I've looked into that a little bit. You know, you can go and look and find some records of like who are the biggest donors to universities. And they do tend to be people, let's say with more left-wing ideologies, which would perhaps include some of this neo-Marxist stuff. Again, I don't want to say that, you know, we want to distinguish. There are different ideas on the left. They're not all can't all be reduced to neo-Marxism, but neo-Marxism is a big one on the left. So yeah, those donors that what I found, and you can find this article, I think it's called something like Doubts About the Big Donors Who Funds American Universities on my Substack. And you can go and see, yeah, you know, follow the money, right? And a lot of the money is coming from people with this perspective. And then, you know, and so if you're a university and a lot of your funding depends on that, you know, then you're going to
You
align
get a piece
with
of, yeah.
the ideas of your donors because you need to financially. Similarly with accrediting agencies. So, you know, these are the agencies that have oversight over universities and basically tell them, give you the thumbs up, yes, you're accredited, you're a real university, your degrees mean something, or no, you know, we're not going to credit you and your degrees don't carry like you know, real weight. And those agencies, from my experience, which is limited, but they tend to be quite left as well. And so that means that they really have universities in a tough spot because if they don't, let's say, meet certain expectations in their for what they'll teach in the curriculum. Of a more, say, identity politics or DEI or woke kind of direction. If you don't do those things, we won't accredit you or you won't keep your accreditation. And then all of a sudden, the university loses its status, it loses its credibility, and it won't have as many students and so on. So I think accrediting agencies play into that. I think the big donors play into that. I think just the way that these ideas were introduced at a really tumultuous time in our history. So, like, you know, they really took off in like the 1960s,
Sixties, yeah.
which was already a time of a lot of instability. And you could say chicken or the egg. I don't know which one caused which, but they came together at just the right moment where, you know, we had racial tensions in
100%.
America. We had a lot going on with feminism in America at that time. And these ideas, I think, fused with that and drew energy from
Percent.
that and perhaps fueled those movements as well, but it was kind of like a symbiotic relationship where they really took off. And so a lot of the, you know, like the older professors now, or maybe more even like the prior generation, would have been kind of like the hippies of the 60s who were in this kind of cultural fever moment where they adopted a lot of revolutionary ideas, and it was coming at them from their peers, it was coming at them from their music, it was coming at them from the Frankfurt School, you know, from their professors, for these exciting new professors from Germany or whatever, right? Who are bringing these ideas and I think fueling that revolutionary fervor. So that whole generation was, you know, strongly formed by, like, let's say the people who came of age in the 60s and 70s would have been really formed by that milieu. And then they went out, of course, and became professors and instilled a lot of those ideas in the next generation and so on. So,
But it went
you
from
know,
like,
Bella Dodd, to go back
oh,
to,
sorry.
go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I was gonna say, but it went from a civil rights moment, right? And women's rights and what have you, which I think we all can get on board with. But then it moved into, and I think you're talking about this, to an anti-American movement. It kind of moved like we want equal rights to what I see now with my generation and people I went to school with to I hate this country. So we started off there. And now we're here. And I can attest to that. I know these people personally, where they are literally say, burn it to the ground.
It's wild.
Physically burn it to the ground, violence. And so that's, I mean, I know you're probably going to get to that, but it's like you go from the civil rights movement and the women's rights movement to now what I see in, you know, my youth and generation, is I hate this country. I hate it. Like,
it's crazy.
My mom escaped the 79 Iranian revolution. Like, she literally escaped a totalitarian dictatorship before the, I mean, I'm like, and I watched these people here. We can get into that another time, but that's where I stand. It's like, you have no idea sometimes.
And do you see, are you seeing a resurgence for younger people? You're around them. You speak to these kids. I mean, you're not a professor necessarily right now. Are you, or are you? Are you still?
You just do writing.
No,
you're just writing mostly.
I was a high school teacher for a while.
That's awesome.
I'm just a writer.
Or are you seeing in your personal life even like a resurgence of people that are recognizing and maybe Lenin is wrong. Maybe that we can change the way people think. Are you seeing that in the young
people?
I see
more people saying I hate this country.
Yeah, but I think there's somewhat of a change as well on the other side of people like kind of recognizing what is happening.
Like an awakening.
Sure. Yeah, at least just my personal conversations with people. I'm wondering if you see the same thing as well, just as much as they're going the other way. But do you see a large group of like, oh, what's happening here?
Sorry, we didn't mean to cut you off either.
Yeah, no, you're good. And I'm sorry, I probably have a bit of a delay. I'm out here in the country, the beautiful rural area, but my internet connection is
nice, man.
I love it. I love it. No worries.
Yeah. But yeah, so, okay, let me try to remember the question here.
We threw another 10 at you.
How did we go from the civil rights movement to hating the country?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think there were people who took advantage of that civil rights movement and the legitimate good that it was trying to accomplish to propel this narrative of even post-civil rights, that America is a fundamentally racist country, mm-hmm. that it is systemically racist, mm-hmm. And that it is, we have this terrible dark history, mm-hmm. and we're just like an unjust society. I mean, it goes back to that Marxist idea of the system is unjust and must be overthrown. Now, there are injustices in society. This is true of every human society throughout history.
Yes.
There's always going to be, unfortunately, injustices because of our fallen human nature, mm-hmm. right? But to take that and then to say, and people make mistakes, right? You know, countries make mistakes. Mm-hmm. But to take that and then say, well, therefore, I hate everything about this country and we have to destroy it and build something new, that's not a rational response.
Yeah.
And by the way, usually the thing that you build in its place is worse.
It's worse.
Right.
You know, so we've seen that many times in history, right? When a revolution sweeps in, maybe it corrects some injustices, but often in the process it creates greater injustices.
Yeah.
That certainly happened in Russia. It happened to some extent at the French Revolution, even mm-hmm. earlier back. But I would say it's that has been fostered, right? This attitude of because there are oppressors in the country or have been, therefore it's a totally flawed country and we just have to throw the whole thing out. And again, that's just a very simplistic way of looking at society and of looking at human behavior.
It's a very retribution. It's almost like, I feel like it's this like, we don't want oppression, but we're going to oppress the people that we feel that were the oppressors. So now they're going to be unequal and we feel that we can attack them and do whatever we want. I mean, we've noticed that. And that's what we've seen. I mean,
reverse racism.
We've come from a very diverse background. But this is what I saw growing up, you know, in South Seattle to East Harlem. It's almost like, okay, yeah, there's injustice, but at the same time, burn it to the ground and now let's be absolutely awful to the people who maybe had nothing to do with anything, but we now have a right. We have this right to be absolutely awful and cruel, you know, humiliate them. And I would just see this over and over. And so I think that's what you were talking about, but
you're onto something there, and it is a concerning trend because this is
it's not Christ-like.
Conversion, right? What we need is forgiveness, like Christian forgiveness.
Yes.
And we need to not exaggerate the evils, but
Yeah.
also not deny the evils that may have
Easily.
happened in the past. But
Yes.
ultimately, we have to reconcile and move forward. But there are people that, like you said, they just want revenge. They want
Yeah.
retribution for real or imagined evils that may
Yeah.
have happened. And that just is never the path forward. In fact, it tends to lead to, as I said, greater evils. So, Jordan Peterson, you've probably heard of him. He talks a lot about problems with neo-Marxism, but he did some research into the kind of language and dialogue that tends to happen before a genocide. And like, what do you see? What's the discourse? What's the social discourse before a genocide happens in history? And it's really concerning, because what he found was there's a lot of talk of victimhood. There's a lot of talk of oppressor versus oppressed. There's a lot of painting people as either wholly innocent victims or wholly evil oppressors, right? These two, us versus them. That kind of language tends to go beforehand. The example he gave was actually from the Soviet Union, of, I believe they're called the kulaks. They were these farmers, say middle class, maybe upper middle class farmers who were pretty successful in Russia. And what ended up happening is they were killed off. They were eliminated. And before that happened, they were painted as oppressors. The poor farmers, the lower class people, were told that they were victims, and this animosity was stoked up so that the poor farmers or poor people there would turn against these middle class, more successful farmers, and they would go along with the genocide. So yeah, when you have narratives of victim, if you tell somebody that they are a victim and you tell them that their whole life, well then yeah, they're going to feel justified in enacting some kind of vengeance or some kind of violence
Yeah.
because they think they've been mistreated.
And there's a lack of faith in that. And that's the thing that just shocks me, especially with people that I know. And I can only equate it to people that I have a personal relationship, and I've seen them go down this path, and I love them. And no, we don't have the same political views or things, but it's just turned to a violent rhetoric from them, and it's just shocking. And I mean, I'm not narcissistic to think that I can solve it or change them or think, but it's a lack of Christ, in my opinion, because we are Catholic, we are Christian. And I say, if you are a
Me too.
Christian, that should not even, you love each other. I mean, that's what we stand for. There's no retribution. There's no violence. There's no spitefulness. There's no revenge. And I feel like they've taken on those roles, as opposed to saying, oh, it's Christ first, it's God first. I don't have to agree with you. I don't have to like you. I don't have to even talk to you. You can even say, I hate you, Sarah. I hate what you stand for, but I would never wish harm on you. And I don't see that anymore. And I say, like, yeah, I would used to say maybe 15 years ago, it's those people over there. Oh, no, now it's people that I used to go to dinner with every, now it's, people that we've known for a long time. And
Yeah, it's
so
wild. It is wild.
it's really just become, I feel like, a cancer, especially with those who are believers. It's this annihilation of Christ and God first, which I feel, I mean, I'm just a promoter of that, but I'm just like, if you have that in your life, you cannot have retribution in your mind.
Yeah. And in your Substack, you talk about history and how important history is if you're basically ignorant to history, how very doomed you are. And like, as someone that knows history, what is your thoughts? Like, where do you see us going from here? Do you have an optimistic view of the future? Or are you more on the pessimistic side? Like, what is your viewpoint where we're going?
Yeah. Oh, well, and that reminds me, I didn't completely answer your part of the question, which was you had asked about, is there any kind of counter movement, let's say more to more back to more traditional principles, back to less skepticism about the institutions or something like that, and more American, patriotism. And I would say that I think that's happening.
Oh,
I
good.
think you probably, yeah, probably have some going in both directions. But I do know, for example, there have been some statistics recently just about a religious revival among young people.
Yeah,
Absolutely.
we see it at church.
And yeah, So that's a really hopeful thing, you know. Like you said, Sarah, it's the solution to social conflict ultimately is Christ. You know, we can't have a brotherhood of man without the fatherhood of God. And it's foolish to think that we can. And a lot of history is about us trying, especially modern history, is about us trying to do that, trying to create a utopia with no God in the picture. And what we end up with is a dystopia, usually. But yeah, so people coming back to religion, that's a very hopeful sign. And if that trend continues and if it grows, then if we had let's say, a real, genuine, full-fledged religious revival in America, well, then that's, I think, a very bright future. Because ultimately, it's not so much about this party or that party winning out, in my opinion, although that matters. It's about the conversion of hearts, you know. And if you go to actually a man who lived through a communist dictatorship, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who was a Russian writer, he lived through the horrors of communism in Russia. He was imprisoned in the Gulag, in the labor camps. But his conclusion was very wise, I think. For us to remember as Christians, but also to correct the error of the Marxist or neo-Marxist view, which is very us versus them. His conclusion from his experiences was this. He said, and I'm going to kind of paraphrase, but he said, if only it were so simple as evil people somewhere doing evil things and we could just get rid of them. But he said, it's not like that. The line dividing good from evil runs through every human heart. In other words, you can't just paint it as, oh, we're all good and they're all bad, or this, you know, these are the good guys and these are the bad guys. I mean, you might have more or less good or evil in a particular group, but ultimately, you know, every human heart has the capacity for evil and has the capacity for good. And unfortunately, you know, I feel like with the neo-Marxist narrative, it gives this impression that some people can only do evil, they're only oppressors, and other people can only do good, they're only victims. And that's just really oversimplifies the drama of the human soul, which is that it is a battle between good and evil within us. And so the more that people win the battle for good in their own hearts, in their own lives, you know, the more that we'll see that in society at large, you know, I would say. But I haven't really answered your question. Am I optimistic or pessimistic? I don't know. It's really hard to predict these kinds of things, you know. I think I just choose to be optimistic, I guess. I don't know that I have that grounded in anything particularly.
It's
But I
been
do
kind of
think a
a
lot of people
somber
are.
couple weeks. I mean, with everything that's happened, I honestly, especially here in Arizona, it's just been something where you kind of feel like you fall back and say, what is happening? I remember just after Charlie was assassinated, I just kind of screamed at our crucifix and like, where are you? Like, where are you in all this? Because you just become so defeated sometime. I have a defeatist attitude with it. Especially people of faith, you know, it's just kind of like, why is this being allowed right now? Why are so many people so evil in their heart? Like you talk about in your hearts. This conversion of hearts. Like, you don't have to agree with me on everything, but at least a moral integrity, just a little bit. And that's where I feel like where you feel defeated because you're like, these people don't even have any moral integrity anymore. You don't have to be Catholic. You don't have to be Christian. You can be whatever. You can believe in the universe or rocks and stones, whatever that is that you go by. But I'm like, at least have some decency about you. And that's what's so disheartening is watching them not have it. And I think that's where my anger comes from a lot of the time.
Well, yeah, there's been a loss of civility. It's very hard to have civil dialogue anymore. And that, again, I would say that it goes back to demonizing the opposition, right? If you're going to treat the other side, whether it's political or whatever, as, you know, evil incarnate, well, then it's very hard to have a civil discussion amongst people.
100%.
And I, you know, it's one thing to think, you know, I'm no moral relativist. I'm not saying that evil doesn't exist or something. It's one thing to think, I could say to someone, I believe your ideas are evil, you know, and to the extent that you let them shape you, it's going to negatively affect you as a person. But we can't just demonize the other side either. And you know, I think you see that like, with whatever assassination or whatever kind of acts of hatred or violence, it's because we've gotten to the point of just viewing things so black and white that we think anything is justified. If if I think you're some evil oppressive right winger, then I can kill you,
And that's
or
where
what
these
have you.
phrases, I mean, I'll say it real quick, and we won't keep it for much longer. You've been amazing, but these are little things that I learned. My degree's in sociology and criminology, and then I went off to New York to become a fashion model, so I don't know what the heck. But now today it's being used for, I'm now like, wait a minute, I learned a lot of this stuff. I mean, it was either FBI or fashion model. But
different spectrums there.
So when I hear phrases like this, Nazi, I mean, these are all direct. These have been directed at all, like, for the greater good. Oh, we heard a lot of that during COVID. By any means necessary is a scary one, because this is something that they adopt now. And each according to their means, each according to their ability. And again, I go back on that phrase where it is very a Marxist ideology. I learned that in college. But is this the modern day equity? Is this kind of where we're seeing this term equity being thrown around? And some people say, oh, it's good, it's great, but when I start digging into what that means, I go back to these key phrases I learned in college where I'm like, I've heard, and reading Atlas Shrugged, well, I've heard each according to their means, each according to their ability. I think I'm saying that right. I may not be, but it's basically, you're producing, but you have to distribute it to
just packaging it differently.
Yeah, it's crazy. So I don't know if that's something that you've seen as well with equity.
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
So there's a journalist named Christopher Ruffo who has done some really good work on this subject, especially critical race theory, and he traces the Marxist origins of it, but.
Yeah.
He says it goes under a lot of euphemisms. It has a lot of disguises.
Yeah.
And one of them, he says, is the term equity. That really equity is not the same thing as what we would think of as equality.
Equality, yeah.
But equity is a cover term for injustice. I mean, it's a cover term for all these ideas about having to get retribution and having to practice sort of basically counter racism, for lack of a better term, where you have to force equality of outcome and things like that as part of the job of equity. So yeah, usually it's related to these woke ideas or these DEI ideas of which are ultimately derived from a Marxist or partly from a Marxist outlook, where it's about it's about trying to force equality, but based on the assumption that everything is currently unjust and therefore has to be changed, and therefore we have to give special treatment here, and we have to not tolerate these people. And I mean, it's weird because it's like it's in the name of tolerance, but it's extremely intolerant.
Exactly.
Well, if you read about it, and I see people throwing it around, I mean, people I know, they have shirts. I mean, it's been infiltrated in sports and stuff, and it sounds good. You're just like equity. Okay,
it does.
But then and it's not. I mean, I'm not trying to be against what people believe in, but at the same time, if you really do the research, it's, you don't start off the same, but you need to end up the same. So everybody needs to end up right here. And that is terrifying, because that eliminates capitalism, it eliminates incentive, it eliminates all these things that drive us as small business owners and what have you. And again, I'll go back to Atlas Shrugged and, what happened in that. It's just, I want to just be like, do you know what this word actually means? I know you think you know what it means, but if you really dive into the implications, it's completely taken away anybody's incentive and capitalistic drive. And
it sounds very American, but I don't think it really is in line with our with the founding principles.
Yeah,
it's more of a communist kind of idea or a Marxist idea. It's
very much so.
It's a refusal to accept. If one, let's take it economically, for example, on the economic side, it's a refusal to accept that there are differences among people that are natural and not necessarily insidious, not necessarily unjust. There's this assumption that if anybody has more power than somebody else, it's necessarily unjust. But that's just not the way God created the world. I mean, he created the world with differences among people, different gifts. Some people might be better at business than other people. Some people might be better at, art or whatever. And he created us with a lot of different gifts that are supposed to be complementary, but not that we should all be like cut out, cookie cutter identical and everything. That just
Exactly.
that removes the, well, it's, it does infringe upon people's freedom, but it also is just not the design that God had for us, and that is in our nature, right? It's just you cannot make everyone identical. And who would
No.
even want that,
Why
right?
would you
We
want
part of the
that?
joy of life is that it has variety.
Exactly.
And you want to, like, I look up to people. I want to aspire to be like somebody. I don't want to be like, we're all the same. We all, it's just like, why would you? I don't understand it. Why would you want that? And I guess to have somebody on who believes in equity and what they're, I mean, obviously, I would love to hear somebody's take on why they promote it, what they mean by it, because I could be completely wrong of what their take on equity is, especially coming from a racial point of view. Like, I don't want to be insensitive to that, but what I see is like basically, you don't deserve this. I need to be the same as you.
It's
And
anti-human, actually. Yeah, it's anti-God,
it's
but
very
that's not how it's
anti-God.
designed.
But I want to break, like, I don't know how much longer we have you, but just I want to touch on,
Yeah, I'm flexible.
oh, good. Okay, good. Bring it into the Catholic institution. So you wrote about that, being that we're Catholic. I don't know if you're Catholic. I don't want to make any assumptions. You are Catholic. Okay. And what I talked about earlier about even my high school, and you just saw this like critical race theory just running rampant. Even, I mean, I graduated, wait, 95 to when I graduated, 1999. So a long time ago. But that was over 20 years ago, and it was happening, and I noticed it. And there was no other opposing viewpoints. And that's one thing I would say, like, why don't you have somebody who's, for this? Why don't you have somebody who's against this? Like, what is happening? Go to University of Washington, and you tell your story about how your teachers were just very Marxist leaning in the English department. Mine too, in sociology, obviously. Very Marx. Like, I don't think we had anybody supporting capitalistic ideas in that department. So it's something that happened. Did you experience that
Yeah, very. I
too?
mean,
Yeah.
probably not as much because, to be honest, to be fair, back then I wasn't
He's being
I wasn't really tapped into what was
honest.
happening in the world of politics,
Were
and
you partying too
I
hard,
was
babe?
partying. Yeah, I was
Okay.
not
You're one of
that
those. All right,
religious.
whatever. I was a nerd.
But now I see it. It's apparent to me. It's very clear.
I walked out of my professor's class. I remember my senior year, she brought a slideshow. I'm supposed to be learning of her and her wife at a protest for George W. Bush, told back then, and he was Hitler, and it was an hour. I walked out though. There was about five of us who got up and go like, screw you, I'm not paying for this crap. But she decided to take the time to teach us about her time at a, this rally she went to that, okay, Bush was Hitler, another Hitler reference.
Got an activist teaching you.
Yeah.
I mean, it was beyond, that was ridiculous. Like, that is, I'm not paying for that. I forget what my question was. Oh my gosh. But you had
Just
the same
like
experience
experience.
in at your university as well, you said. In the Catholic Church, and then moving it into the Catholic realm.
Okay, well, so my experience, yeah, I went to just a state university, so very secular. And in English, as in most of the humanities and social sciences and things, it's just we read almost exclusively neo-Marxist or Marxist-leaning critics, literary theorists. I mean, like you said, there was no other point of view presented. It was just like, oh, this is the only serious academic thing to do, of course, is to be a neo-Marxist,
We're the smartest
which
people in
is silly
the room.
because it's like It's not that old of an idea, really. It's
Yeah.
been popular not for that long. It's like for centuries, people were doing other things in literature, but whatever.
Yeah.
So they present it as though it's the only thing to do. And yeah, it's highly politicized. And I want to add one other ingredient here.
Yeah.
I think part of what's afflicting education is not just the neo-Marxist identity politics, but also what we could describe broadly as postmodern philosophy, which is characterized by skepticism, a rejection of the idea of truth, a refusal to accept any broad narrative explanations of the world, and just to assume that everything is false, everything is relative, right? It's this relativism. So what you have is you've got an institution, the university, that is supposed to be about the pursuit of truth, and yet has rejected the very idea of truth. And so then what are they left to do? Like, what do you do if you've rejected the very reason for your existence? And what most of them have decided on is politics. They've said, like, okay, well, we don't believe in truth anymore. So it's not like we could, read a book to try to get to the truth about something. Let's just read the book to push a political narrative, or let's show our students a slideshow of this protest we went to, like in your case. That's all they have to do because they no longer believe in truth. And they've just sort of defaulted to political activism in a lot of cases. So I did have instances like that in my college years where it's just like blatantly,
It
about
was just,
politics
it's
and
just,
about the professor's particular perspective on politics and not about subject matter or about truth,
yeah.
certainly. One of the most memorable instances I think I had was when I had a professor who announced, in class that he was going to become a woman. And this was even a little before the trans thing
Yeah.
blew up. This was a few years before that. And he just kind of took the class as like the opportunity to kind of proclaim his personal beliefs about his gender, which was a bizarre thing to
It's
do, and not
interesting.
very professional.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I had instances like that. Now, again, I do want to be clear that I had a lot of very good professors, intelligent people with a lot of good intentions, and I learned a lot from them. I don't want to paint them all as though they're, bad people.
Yeah.
That's not the case. I happen to disagree with them on a lot of fundamental beliefs,
Yeah.
but they were good-hearted people in many cases. I just think they were wrong about a lot of things. So yeah, I don't know if I could call any of my professors conservative or traditionally minded. And the data bears that out.
Oh,
I've looked into
yeah.
this as well. I wrote
Yeah.
something pretty recently for Intellectual Takeout, about bias in academia, and the data does show like it's mostly liberals
Oh, of course.
in college and education. You can do the statistics on it,
Yeah.
and it's pretty clear.
Yeah.
So there is that bias. Of course, there's universities that are outliers, and there's good colleges out there.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's heavily dominated in that direction. Now, as far as what was the other part of your question about like Catholic education? Is
Well,
that what
so
you were
no, you
asking
wrote
about?
about this and you said how like they infiltrate organizations or groups that are anti-communist, but they find a way to come in and or who are opposed to it, and you written about that and how they find a way to kind of flip it around. So you start seeing these like Marxist ideas, maybe not so blatant, but you start seeing it more and more. And you spoke about the Catholic Church. I even talked to my mom, who's a, I mean, we're devout Catholics, but she's very devout Catholic. And she was like, oh yeah, I've seen that. You know, she was very much in agreement when I was researching a lot of your work. And so I would love for you to kind of, because I even said that with even, you know, the high school that I went to, I mean, this again, long time ago, this was something that was happening. Again, it's the environment too. It's just, you know, Seattle, Washington, you know, so you're kind of already encapsulated in a very, very liberal environment.
I kind of
But
want to piggyback off your question
piggyback,
a
babe.
little
Sorry,
bit.
are you
It's my
here?
last question, but
He just got back from the fire station like 2 hours
no, but like
ago.
I'm always curious how people find their faith, and you are surrounded by these, liberal people, and you are more of have that conservative mentality, right? And I grew up probably around more, I think, more liberal.
I did too.
You
yeah.
as well.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's like, how did we become?
You guys are such an anomaly. I'm like, well.
Where did you find? I always feel like I have to ask this question because we're a Catholic show. I'm like, how did you find your faith personally? Like, how did that journey happen to
ask
you?
Ask my question first. Ask my question first.
I know that might be a long answer. Well, in best you can, but you know, how did you find your faith? Like, what was that process like?
So how does it infiltrate the Catholic, has it, you feel like it infiltrated the Catholic church school, and then how did you get into your faith so heavily?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll take them in order. So yeah, I think in the article on my Substack where I was trying to present the evidence for the infiltration of American education, I said that, you know, figures like Bella Dodd, who was a communist agent who defected and left it and converted to Catholicism, that she said that the communists had also tried to infiltrate seminaries in the Catholic Church, you know, to get guys up the ranks within the Catholic Church. Now, do I know that definitively? No, you know, I think it would take a deeper investigation, and there's people who would dispute that. There's, you know, I think it's not unreasonable to imagine that there was an attempt at that. You know, because the Catholic Church, of course, is a huge opponent of communism as well. So if the communists, you know, trying to compromise their enemies, then they're going to target the Catholic Church, and they certainly wouldn't be the first group to target the Catholic Church. But because she is indefectible, you know, they never win out in the end, and the church will prevail even when she is attacked and infiltrated. So, you know, I don't know the extent to which that might have happened. Like I said, Bella Dodd is a person that people point to a lot as giving evidence for this. And, you know, you look at the state of some of the seminaries in the mid and late 20th century, and you definitely come away with questions like, what on earth is going on here? There were some really bad things happening in the seminaries, bad formation, homosexuality, things like this, which could have been the result of communist attacks as well as other things. From what I understand, they're better now, thanks be to God. The seminaries are improving. But yeah, there was kind of a bad spell there with that. I can't really speak to it beyond that. I just don't have enough knowledge. I would say that you had strains of theology that were influenced by Marxism. So a classic example would be liberation theology, which I think was kind of a South American thing, but they were basically trying to insert Marxism into Catholicism, which just doesn't work. You know, it's heretical, but they're trying to reduce Catholicism to like another political, like a way of achieving Marxism. And that was pretty clearly condemned by Pope John Paul II. Well, Cardinal Ratzinger was the head of the CDF at that time. And so he wrote and kind of clearly said, no, this is wrong. You can't combine Catholicism and Marxism in that way. So that, unfortunately, that was pretty clearly spoken against by the magisterium. But you know, it made inroads in different places, and just because the Vatican spoke out against it doesn't mean that it disappeared. And you know, there's still, I think to this day, there's still places influenced by that that kind of theology, faulty theology. So yeah, you know, it's all around us. But as I said too, it kind of, it does morph and change, and you know, it's not like we have a lot of people running around who would call themselves classical Marxists. It's just they have those influences, you know, somewhere in there. So I don't know if that answers your question. Similarly with Catholic schools, you know, I don't know the full story there, but it seems like we went through a period of pretty profoundly bad catechesis in Catholic schools. People not being taught the faith in an Orthodox way.
100%.
And you know, some of those people were perhaps Marxists. I don't know. You know, it wouldn't be surprising. You know, some of the people teaching
the bad
theology.
I would say there's no other way to describe it, because what I saw was just that. It was just kind of like, what are you teaching? Are we a Catholic school, or are we just some kind of like radicalized pushing agendas again, no opposing viewpoints, nobody else to come in and counter whatever it is that you thought that the Catholics, you know, thought or believed in. It was just such an eye opener to me. And that's kind of where I started forming my views on society, was in high school, because it didn't add up to me. Things were just not adding up to what they were trying to convince me and other people to believe in. I know you went to Catholic school for a little bit as well, but no, I mean, we love our faith. We love the church. We wouldn't want to be anywhere else. I mean, we love it. The Fatima, you know, Fatima, her apparition, Mama Mary's apparition during Fatima, she warned us against communism. So, I mean,
And then the other question, unless you wanted to jump in there.
We'll bring it home now. Like how did you get into your faith, and tell us about that?
So, I'm a cradle Catholic. So I've been Catholic my whole life, and I was homeschooled for a good portion of my education, kind of into like the middle of high school. And so, I think I avoided some of the pitfalls. I might have encountered with, let's say, like a not a good Catholic school or something. And there are plenty of good Catholic schools too, but there's bad ones. And then that's almost worse than a bad public school in some ways. But I had a pretty strong formation. Like, my family was very into the faith from a young age, and I was taught the catechism, the Baltimore Catechism, and you know, that really lays out the foundations of the faith very well. That was just part of my upbringing. So by the time I got to college, I would say I was already pretty firmly rooted in the Catholic faith. And I was never even tempted by the neo-Marxist stuff. It just didn't appeal to me. It didn't make sense to me, I guess, given my background. And, you know, God bless my parents for providing that for me, and the priests as well that I knew. So... yeah, that's not a very exciting story.
I was just curious.
It's great. No,
kind of how people come about it. And
there's certainly been, I hope, a deepening of faith over time, but I wouldn't say that I ever had like a traumatic moment of conversion or like, I've got to come back to the faith,
because
I've always practiced it.
That's awesome.
That's beautiful.
By the grace of God.
Yeah. Amen.
It was such a pleasure to have you.
I feel like you want to plug.
Tell us where we can find you.
Yeah. So my home base on the internet is my Substack.
Okay.
It's thehazelnut.substack.com.
Okay.
So you can find me there, and I kind of collect most of my articles there. There's other ones that don't make it there, but, and then I write regularly for the Epoch Times.
Okay.
And Intellectual Takeout. Those are my two main publications.
Nice.
So if you Google my name and the Epoch Times, you know, you'd probably find my author page there. I have a couple of novels out there. I self-published a couple of novels. You can find those on Amazon. And and then I guess I have an author website too. If you search, or if you put in WalkerLarsonWriting.com,
we'll put that in
where you can see my books, and then it links to the Substack, and just kind of an overview of what I do. So, yeah, I write about, you know, these kinds of topics. History, literature is, of course, one of my main focuses. It's what I studied, but also I'll write, you know, things about Catholicism and education, and the general kind of collection of things we've been talking about. So, I really appreciate the invitation to come on, and I hope it was helpful, and I hope it's helpful to your listeners.
Absolutely. I feel like I went back to school, and I love this.
Yeah.
Walker, it was such a pleasure having
you.
I could talk to you all day, but
yeah, it was great meeting you.
Yeah, thank you guys. It's been fun. I really appreciate it.
Have a blessed day, and we'll talk soon.
All right. Take care.
Bye.